Now live from Everbank Field, 1010 XL 92.5 FM presents Jaguars Today with your host Mike Dempsey and Jeff Lagerman.
All right, welcome in, everybody. Happy Tuesday. Dialagi is here. We'll talk a little NFL playoff football. We'll talk about the Jags 2015 season. And we'll talk a little national championship game as well. You see Lane Kiffin got left behind. The buses forgot him. Didn't wait for him after the game.
Well, why wasn't he on the bus?
I guess he was, I don't know, making the rounds, maybe saying hello to family and friends who were in visiting. I have no idea
why he wasn't on the bus. He's got a bad reputation, and it continues to grow.
Is that the worst thing in the world, that he missed the bus after the championship game? They won the game, man. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, but still, man, you're a coach. Get on the bus.
What's the big – I don't understand the big deal. Season's over. As far as – I just think it's funny that he got left behind. I'm not angry at the
guy. I guarantee you Nick Saban knew – that he was unaccounted for, and Nick Saban said, let's roll.
Roll the bus. And maybe he did.
It's like the elevator in Miami with his wife.
Whatever. Nick had to get a head start on his one day off. He's going to take today and enjoy it and get right back to
did
grinding
he smile?
Away.
I was actually out watching the game, so I didn't see any of the post game. Did he smile in the post game at all?
He smiled. One time I caught him smile on the sideline was after the onside kick. Really, they went over to him, and he had said the biggest grin in his face, like, man.
Gutsy call.
We game plan that. And real, Jet, was it that hard? When you consider the alignment that Clemson is in, have you ever seen a team put eight guys up that close and have them all that bunched up towards the middle of the field?
In college football, yeah.
Boy.
Yeah, I mean, college football, they get creative in some of the formations. Kickoff is no different. A lot of times they kind of bunch it up, and then they all scatter out to their lanes. You don't see that as much in the National Football League.
I don't think
league.
You'll see it as much in Clemson anymore.
No, and great call. I mean, how in the world, though, the kicker is able to kick one that goes up in the air and is caught on the run, 15, 18 yards down the field.
Right.
I mean, what a great kick.
Well, it's like chipping from like a few feet off the green, right? I'll putt them all. And then you see these guys and they bring out the sand wedge and they open the face up and they hit it straight up in the air from like 8 feet from the stick. And you're like, how did that happen?
Yeah.
That was kind of like that, right? And they hit the guy in stride. It's pretty amazing.
And then the guy was, I mean, right, it was almost like a pass.
Right, it was almost perfect. Like he could have just, it's against the rules once he has possession, the play's down. But it was almost like if he wasn't worried about securing the ball, he kind of ran out of bounds so the guy couldn't try to swat it out of his arms. He might have been able to just take that and pick up a big chunk of yardage headed, I've never seen one caught on the fly like that.
Neither have I in a bold call. I mean, one that will remember forever.
I think it won the game.
You know, just like the onside kick in the Super Bowl.
Right. You know, right. The New Orleans Saints against
Sean
Colts.
Payton made a gutsy call coming out at halftime. And
I think it was kind of a similar situation right now. I'm sure they had scouted it and knew if the opportunity was there, they might pull it out. But it was a feel. Didn't it feel the game like might be whoever has the ball last, right? And mm-hmm. and because Alabama had tied it, Clemson would have a chance to take the lead, and Alabama would be playing catch-up if they continue to both play well offensively, and that kind of flipped the whole dynamic of, you know, then Alabama able to take the short field, drive it down, get a touchdown, and play from ahead essentially the rest of the way.
Yeah, it was I watched first half, and then it was it for me, time to go to bed. But watching the first half and watching Clemson all year long, a lot of people – we're saying that Alabama's going to be able to control the line of scrimmage, and I'm going, I don't know what you're seeing if you think that Alabama's going to be able to control the line of scrimmage completely, because Clemson's got some great athletes up front and got speed, and they were a little nicked up, you know, with their defensive end, their star defensive end, but he still had an impactful game, you know. But I felt that that was going to be about as entertaining of a game as there was going to be, and I thought that if Clemson could contain – that great running back, the pride of Yulee, you know, could contain him, that they would have a chance.
Didn't it feel like they kind of contained him even though he ran for a $1.58, right?
I thought both defensive lines really controlled the game. I thought they both did, and the difference for Clemson was going to be Deshaun Watson's ability to make plays even when that was happening.
Right, because when the pocket collapsed, Coker, for the most part, was a sitting duck.
Yeah. And Watson was making plays. He was moving around and making plays with his legs, with his arm. And for a sophomore to see the field as well as he does as a passer moving out of the pocket is pretty impressive. College football has to deal with him for another year, and I agree with you, Jeff. I think he's going to be one of those guys that's going to be mentioned as a top 10 prospect coming out of college next year.
I think his receivers did a great job, too. Tight ends as well. Man, they caught some balls that got on him pretty quickly last night.
And I thought that Nick Saban hit it dead on the money. Did you see the interview with him going in at halftime?
I don't think I did.
Yeah, he was dead on the money, and he said that, you know, right now we're doing a really good job against them. He says, but their quarterback is just, you know, John Watson is doing a tremendous job, and we've got to find an answer to him. And then on the flip side of that, you know, you had mentioned about the pressure on Alabama's quarterback, Coker. The first half, it wasn't on his offensive line. The first half, it was on him. He's got to get rid of the ball. He held the ball, I can think of four or five times in which Clemson got sacked. He's got to get rid of the ball. And Nick Saban called him out. I mean, going at halftime, he said, our quarterback's got to get rid of the ball. We can't hang on to it as long as we are. And it wasn't about protection. It was about the performance of the quarterback. And I think that that's probably the one of the most amazing things is that typically national titles come along with great players and great quarterbacks too. But Nick Saban's been able to do that without a great quarterback. I mean, if anybody thinks that A.J. McCarron is a great quarterback, they're crazy. I mean, he was an excellent college quarterback, but it was the talent that was around him that allowed him to be as successful as he was. And Coker, I don't think, is any different than A.J. McCarron. He's got a below-average arm, but they're smart players. They protect the football. And Nick Saban should get a lot of credit for coaching that up in that position.
Yeah, I don't think Mackenzie Alexander would have been guarding O.J. Howard last night, but you just wonder if, had he been healthy and they had the options to do some different things at the secondary, how that could have impacted the second half, because they just had no answer. They kept losing him in the secondary, wide open.
Three times safety for Clemson just got caught standing flat-footed, just staring at things happening in front of him instead of marking his man. And all three times, Alabama made him pay with touchdowns. I mean, it was pretty incredible that you see busts in football games, and every now and then they're just missed, pressure, whatever gets in the way of you being able to make those plays. Alabama was 4-for-4. When Clemson busted, Alabama killed them in that game last night to the tune of 45 points.
All right, so a lot of big plays last night. A lot of big plays as we bring it back to the Jacksonville Jaguars in the 2015 season, even though the record wasn't ultimately what they hoped it would be at 5-11. So, you know, one thing that J.P. Shadrick is doing, he's having a lot of the media members vote on the top plays of the season. He gave us a list of plays to choose from. We're not going to limit people to that list, but we posted the list on the Jaguars Today Facebook page, and the question of the day is this. What are your top three plays from the Jaguar season? You may not need the list. They may leap right to mind for you. I know several of them did for me as well, but it was helpful to have that. So if you want to have the list as an aid, go to the Facebook.com/Jaguars Today page, or just join us on Twitter today at MD_1010XL, at Logs56, LOGS56, and at 1010XL Fat Tony, and vote for your top three plays of the 2015 season for the Jacksonville Jaguars. Mike Dempsey, Jeff Logman, Fat Tony here with you. We'll take your calls today at 641-1010. You can also text us at that number on the Boston's Restaurant and Sports Bar text line. You've got the Twitter handles, the Facebook page. It's all open for business. Jaguars Today rolls on 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
Shotgun run, Henry to the right. First down and one, 45-40. The Heisman winner's at the 30. He's gone! 20-10! Touchdown, Alabama! Derrick Henry, 50 yards! The first score of the game on third and short. Coker takes the snap, turns, gives to Henry, fighting, spinning at the goal line, still churning, but I don't think he got in. I think he's been held short of the goal line. He is ruled short of the goal line. 1:11 left. Alabama will bleed the clock down here. And now it is ruled touchdown! It's ruled an Alabama touchdown 6 seconds after the play looked to be done.
Looked like the right call the second time around, or at least on the delayed call. I don't know how they call that after such a delay on the field. I can understand all if the scoring plays are reviewed and you check it out. It's one of those weird things. You know, no call. Looks like they're going to call him down short, and then like 10, 15 seconds go by, and all of a sudden it's a touchdown. You know, like, at what point did the guy who had the angle that saw him break the play not just say, hey, guys, over here, got my hand up. Right. That's good.
And
that's
as soon
good.
As they showed the overhead, you're like, oh, yeah, it's a touchdown.
Right, especially the one they shot right, like, almost ground level. I don't know if it was a pylon cam.
It was.
Was it a pylon cam facing down the line? That was the best shot of all.
I don't know how you saw it. Like, they were lucky to be able to see Derrick Henry in that mass of bodies from that angle. But you could clearly see him and the ball to cross the plane.
The best one was the overhead shot when Coker tried to – was it Coker trying to sneak it? And he just got engulfed. And it was like, it was this weird thing, Jeff. I think it was in the second half, so you might have missed this play. And you're like, usually you can say, okay, I know where this guy's head is. It was like he went down and everyone formed a circle around him. They all dove to the middle at the same time. It was like he was swallowed alive. It was this weird look. He completely disappeared.
It was like a sinkhole.
Let me ask you,
yeah,
Jeff.
Wait a minute. One quick thing. Say the pylon cam?
Pylon cam, yeah.
What should it be named?
Shouldn't it be the pylon cam?
I think it should be the Bill Belichick pylon cam. I mean, he was the one who for years has been talking about putting cameras in the pylon.
He was right. It's a great angle.
And the NFL resisted it for so long. You remember last year or whatever, they were talking about, well, it's just cost too much money.
Give me a break. Yeah. Nothing costs the NFL too much money.
No.
Do you think it costs too much money, or do you think they didn't want the referees constantly being second-guessed and opening up to further, look, they missed that one as well. They had to review that one. Good thing we've got the pylon cam.
I think it was great, and I think his idea is great, and I still think it is, and I think that it adds to the broadcast.
Well, you know what? He's also advocating for all plays being reviewed,
which I agree with,
right?
As well.
And I think ultimately it will go that way, yeah. with some minor exceptions, and you know, maybe he is just a guy ahead of his time.
Yeah.
He is probably in many ways.
Considering the pylon cam had the two coolest replays of the game last night. It had the one on the touchdown for Derrick Henry where it was amazing, you saw the ball, and the Drake kick return where it looked like he might have stepped out of bounds at about
right.
the 5, and they went to the pylon cam, which is right down the line. You could see he was maybe an inch
right.
in bounds. It was an incredible replay, and no other camera may have been able to catch that.
Dude was so out of gas.
I
he
know.
Was so out of gas, man. He dove from, like, the 5-yard line and stretched that thing out, and I don't think he would have, if he was from the 5.5, I think he might have been just short. He was out of gas at that point in time. Do you think Derrick Henry is a good pro prospect?
I think he's hands down a great prospect. I mean, I thought last year, watching him with T.J. Yeldon, I remember watching Alabama play last year, and, you know, I don't watch a ton of football, but I watch enough to have seen Alabama play last year and this year. And I just think he's a tremendous back, and I remember when T.J. was there, I was going, why are you putting T.J. Yeldon in? I mean, put in Derrick Henry.
Who
he's
rips
a
off
better
like 8
player.
Yards every time he carries it.
Yeah. I mean, if you compare T.J. Yeldon and Derrick Henry last year, when on the field at the same time, Derrick Henry was clearly the best player that they had at that position.
Does he, though, for a running back that size, does he have enough lateral quickness and, you know, to avoid just getting blown up in the pros? Everybody's fast. Everybody's strong. He's still going to be a man among boys at running back, but there have been other big guys. I mean, Adrian Peterson's a big guy. Steven Jackson's a big guy. There have been big guys, but typically they seem to have been a little bit shiftier. I'm not denying, look, he's a hell of a player, won the Heisman. I'm not saying it's undeserved, the greatest high school rusher of all time. He certainly looks like he's got long speed.
He doesn't look fast, though, because he's a long strider.
Right, but he doesn't get caught a whole lot, right?
No.
And he's run for a number of long touchdowns. I'm just wondering, Jeff, though, in the hole, does he have those quick feet to make the initial guy miss at the NFL level?
Yes, and the reason I say that is, when you watched Emmitt Smith play the game, Emmitt never had great, you know, T.J. Yeldon, Barry Sanders-type lateral movement. Everything that Emmitt had was very subtle, but Emmitt was so strong that a little subtle move would allow him to be able to break a tackle because he had the right angle. And I see Derrick Henry as the same type of player. He has a subtleness about him to where nobody ever can square up on him, and that's why you see 6'4", or whatever, how tall he is, falling forward every time. Because he has a subtle lateral movement to him that it's kind of hard to pick because it's not so herky-jerky like you see a lot of running backs have.
In your eyes, from what you've seen, I don't know how much Ohio State you've watched, is he a better pro prospect than Ezekiel Elliott?
I haven't seen enough of him to make a comment on that.
Because most people feel like if there's a running back that's going to go in the first round, at least as they feel in January, the pundits feel that Ezekiel Elliott is the most likely option. He's a little more compact, you know. He's still a big guy.
Is he draft eligible though?
Yes.
Yeah. He's
both of
out.
Them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, assuming they both opt
yeah.
to
yeah.
Take
It'll
that.
It'll be interesting to watch.
If you're a running back, why wouldn't you? Right. I mean,
well,
especially Derrick Henry. They're giving the ball like 45 times a game down
the
stretch.
Well, he's durable. He's fast. He's big. He's got every attribute that you want. He can make the big play. He's got good hands. I don't see anything wrong with him whatsoever. I think he's a great prospect. I remember when he was coming out, everybody was saying, what would he play? And I'm sitting there going, what do you mean, what would he play when he gets to college? He's going to play running back. You know, like, while they're stable at Alabama so deep, you know, could they move him to tight end? No. He's a running back. He's a big running back. He's got kind of little similarities to Eric Dickerson, you know, as far as the length. You know, Eric was a pretty long guy, and Eric was incredibly strong. Eric kind of had a little bit of that subtleness, too, to his game, to where he never was a herky-jerky guy, but he was just so smooth and fluid. The only thing that I don't think that he's going to have is a lot of longevity, just because he's a pounder.
You know, right.
He takes hits and he goes through it. And if Derrick Henry can be able to fight through it and have a long career, I'd be surprised, because he's more of along the lines of, you know, that Earl Campbell type, but he's not a guy that initiates contact, but he's a guy that is a bruising back and never shies away from it.
What do you think is, when you've got a guy like that, if you're evaluating whether or not to draft a running back, how long into the future do coaches and GMs think? Do they think beyond their tenure? I know you hear a lot here, Dave Caldwell and Gus Bradley like to say, especially Gus I hear saying a lot, we need to do what's best for this franchise. Even that the implication is, even in the short term, may not be the best for me. If we think the best thing for this franchise longevity is to go a certain direction with a player or a player acquisition or whatever the case, when you look at a guy like Derrick Henry, if you feel like, you know what, 4 to 5 years from now, he may be used up. If that's how you feel, how do you think GMs will factor that into where they would draft him?
Well, I don't think it's so much of that, because I think every GM looks at the running back position that there's a limited shelf life. I mean, very few times do you ever have a guy that's going to play 10 years. You know, and then also the running back position overall is just not a premium position anymore. I mean, when Todd Gurley got drafted last year, what was it, 10th overall, coming off of an ACL, I was shocked. I mean, absolutely shocked. And to be honest with you, the Rams made the move, and I was surprised by it because they didn't have that luxury of drafting a running back that high. They weren't that good everywhere else. And so, I mean, with Derrick Henry, I mean, for me, I mean, if I was making the decision as a general manager, you know, I would never even consider drafting a running back in the top 20. I just don't think that the position is worth that in the National Football League. I mean, if you look at all the teams that are in the playoffs right now, who's got a great back?
Minnesota.
Yeah, and they're out.
I'm just saying, right, but, you know, that was the one that came to mind. I mean, you could argue, and Seattle did it down the stretch without Marshawn Lynch, but he's proven to be over time.
And what round picks were Rawls and... And
undrafted.
Yeah, you know, so I mean,
oh, I get it.
You know, it's kind of tough. You know, for me, the premium positions to draft high, it's defensive back, it's pass rushers, it's offensive linemen. Premium positions that, one, either have the ability to have the longevity, or two, and then it's just a position that you just, it's hard to find guys to play.
You know, we were talking here a couple weeks ago with John Osier from Jaguars.com, obviously, and he said he felt like the left tackle position was not quite the premier draft focus that it was even a few years ago. And I don't want to put words into his mouth, but he said in part because you got a lot of the best pass rushers are now starting to line up on the other side, but in part as well because you see the proliferation of spread offenses in college. You don't see the typical, they're being asked to do different things. They're not being prepared the same way. That to me is different. It's different to say there aren't enough guys worthy of that kind of selection, but clearly I still feel at least clearly left tackle is worthy of as high as you want to pick him. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I think offensive line is still a premium position. It gives you the ability to have more people out in the routes. And so it's not just a premium position because you're blocking pass rushers. Part of it is that, but it's also the longevity factor. You know, I mean, very rare.
Those guys can play 10.
I mean, those guys are playing
years,
10
right?
years and more. You know, and playing at a high level for 10 years or more. I mean, what year is this for Joe Thomas?
Seven, eight.
Yeah, 7, 8 years, something like that.
He's about 30 years old
now. Missed a snap.
Right.
Know, he's been available all the time. I mean, now, that's not very common. But, I mean, when you can draft a position and say, okay, that's taken care of for the next decade or could be taken care of for the next decade versus running back and most running backs, you know, 6, 7 years, and all of a sudden they start to slow down, most of them on average. You know, so, I mean, that has to be factored in. And from a X's and O's standpoint, you know, the addition of Jeremy Parnell to this Jaguars football team this year was incredibly huge because last year, you were always having to protect somebody with somebody over there at the right tackle spot. And this year, you never gave help to Jeremy Parnell. You know, you felt very confident that he could block everybody. So that just gives you an additional guy in the route tree that makes it the playbook kind of open up and for play calling when you're an offensive coordinator.
We'll talk a little bit more about the Jags offensive line situation if you'd like to get in today. 641-1010 is the phone number. Today's fan feedback question of the day asks you to go back in your memory banks from the season that was and give us your vote for the top three plays for the Jaguars for 2015. If you go to the Jaguars Today Facebook page, we've got a number of plays highlighted there, a list of possible candidates to vote for. You're not limited to that, but it'll give you a starting point in case you forget any of the major ones. You can check that out or vote on Twitter as well. Mike Dempsey, Jeff Loggeman, Fat Tony here with you. It's Jaguars Today on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Now more with Jeff Loggeman, brought to you by Roland Reich Plumbing on Jaguars Today, 1010XL 92.5 FM.
All right, Mike Dempsey, Jeff Loggeman, Fat Tony with you here on Jaguars Today on this Tuesday morning on 1010XL 92.5 FM down at Everbank. And we'll get into top plays of the season. We'll go through our discussion a little bit later on the show of what we think some of the ones that stand out. I'm sure Andre Branch's strip sack return is going to get a lot of love.
Sure.
I voted that number one. It was a game-changing play. When I voted in my process, Jeff, it wasn't just about the degree of difficulty of the play, but the impact on the game. And was the game still to be determined? You know what I mean? An acrobatic catch in a blowout wasn't going to get as much from me as a more routine catch in a clutch situation.
I had that as my number two.
Did you have that as your number? What was your number one play?
Hearn's game winner in Buffalo.
Against in London.
Yeah, me too.
I think I had that as six, actually. Certainly you could put that in there. I thought that game had so many big plays. I actually thought Telvin's interception in that game ranked higher for me.
I had that number seven.
So there you go. So, I mean, yeah. We probably had some similar ones in the top ten, but we'll go through our top handful of picks a little bit later on.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Because you're probably the same mindset of me. Did you have anything in there that didn't contribute to a victory?
Yes, but right down at the end.
Me too. The last two were non-victorious plays.
Two of the last three for me, okay. And all the rest came from wins.
Let me guess what they are.
Okay.
Okay, A-Rob touchdown record or the one that he had in New Orleans.
The 90-yarder, right? Because I felt like even though it wasn't the record breaker, it was the record establisher, and it was a 90-yarder, right?
Yeah.
Longest play, so I had that as number 10 for me.
I had that as number 10 as well.
All right.
Great minds think alike. My number 9 was Bortles passing the Mark Brunell single-season record.
I considered it, but I just thought it was one of those things that seemed inevitable to me. You know what I mean? And that play itself wasn't anything in particular. The one I had was Posluszny's interception of Cam Newton back in the opener. Cause I went back and looked at the box score at the time. It was a 3-3 ball game. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're right there in that football game and he gets the pick, sets him up, and ultimately Myers would miss a field goal. And the Jags then gave up a touchdown. They scored one of their own they had a chance to take the lead in the first half of that football game, season opener, and we didn't realize how good Carolina was at the time.
Yeah, the reason I had the Bortles, passing the Brunell record, it wasn't so much about, passing Brunell, but it was more about recognizing what a tremendous year that he had in his second year as a quarterback.
There are no wrong answers.
No. They're all great plays, and those are the only two plays that I had that were in games that did not end up in a victory.
What stood out to you, Tony, from any in terms of plays from a loss?
I had the A-Rob touchdown. The 90-yard touchdown was one of my 10. And the other one I had, I only had two. The other one I had was the Telvin Smith strip of Mariota in the fourth quarter of that Tennessee game because it put them in a position where they could have won that football game. It was the fumble on the snap going after all that happened. But the play by Telvin Smith certainly put them in position, gave them serve back in that football game, so I had it in my 10.
All right, if you want to vote on that, you certainly may on Twitter or on the phone lines or on the Jaguars Today Facebook page. What are your top three plays of the 2015 season for the Jacksonville Jaguars? Let's get some calls going, including some people want to talk a little bit about the NFL postseason, which we haven't touched on yet with Jeff. Let's go to DJ on the South Side first up today on Jaguars Today. Good morning, DJ.
Good morning, guys. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I made an observation. I got a question. I'm bringing it back to the Jaguars. We're watching the playoffs, wild card weekend. I think we had some unbelievable defensive performance, even on the losing teams. Also, my how I bring it back to the Jaguars is I seen that those defense was tough, nasty, gritty. Even Minnesota defense, like Seattle, had to fight for every inch, every yard, got some breaks. How does our Jaguar team get tough and nasty for this upcoming season? Because I think that's the mentality for playoff football. It's the tough, nasty defenses.
Yeah, all right. Well, let me add this. You know, you recognize the Minnesota Vikings and the performance that they had against Seattle at home. And I don't think there was a better defense in the National Football League down the stretch than the Minnesota Vikings. I might be wrong with that, but I think they were like one of the top defenses in the league if you go back X number of weeks to end the season. So it's not like what they did was a fluke and they got tough all of a sudden in the playoffs. I mean, that was a good defense that's been playing good football, and they got healthier once they got into the postseason. And how do the Jaguars find toughness? I mean, to me, it's pretty simple. You got to get better players, and you got to get better players and better speed and game-changing players. You know, Telvin Smith is a game-changing player. We just got done talking about top plays of the season. We're talking about plays in which Telvin Smith took the ball away and did something with it and gave the team an opportunity at making something positive happen in progress towards a victory. What other defensive players were on that lift? Andre Branch with the quadfecta, game-changing play. But how many of those did he have? It was one.
Right.
It was one in 16 games. How many other defensive players are on that list? Jared Odrick, sack, cause, fumble against Miami. One play, okay? How many interceptions were there besides
Paul Pierce? Well, there weren't many, period, right?
I mean that's the problem. You know, I mean, that you need to have game-changing plays by the defense, and it takes game-changing players to make those plays. And right now, they don't have them. They got to have more. They got to have more players that can have impactful plays at taking the ball away, disrupting field position along those lines to be able to take the next step.
All right, let's DJ, thank you for the call. Let's go to Chuck on the south side next up this morning on Jaguars Today. Good morning, Chuck.
Hey, good morning, guys. Watch college football. What do you guys think about Laramie Tunsil? I don't know if he's going to be available wherever he picked, but I watched him in the Sugar Bowl game against Oklahoma State, and he looks to me like the most pro-ready player in the draft. I mean, that guy's just a – I mean, he's really, really good. I mean, if he's there, do you take him?
I think he is under – put it this way, Jeff, whether you have watched the film on Laramie Tunsil or not, broaden it out to more just the idea of taking an offensive tackle with the fifth pick in this year's draft. Let's say, as many people feel, Joey Bosa, top pass rusher, right?
Well, Jalen
Jalen Ramsey, a definite consideration for the Jags. Let's say they're both off the board, right? A quarterback goes to Cleveland, and maybe it would take someone trading up to Tennessee's pick to get a quarterback, because a lot of people project them taking Tunsil with the top pick overall. But let's say the projected top offensive tackle in the draft was there, and your top couple of defensive players are not available to you. Is it even a consideration, in your opinion, that Dave Caldwell would consider going that direction in a draft that we know they need to come out with a lot of defensive help?
I don't see it. Would I make a call to make an offensive lineman? For me, no. I think you got enough depth, you'll be fine. I think you got enough competition that you'll get better. But right now, you're lacking on defense. And I would be shocked if there's not somebody if that top lineman were available, if the next top defensive player, the rating would be that drastically different. I just don't see it. And a lot of people say, well, you know, it's a significant drop-off. You know, every year in the draft, they talk about significant drop-offs when you get to a certain pick number X, and then all of a sudden it's not there for this particular position. Well, history has shown that that's not the case. History has shown that there are great players still available at pretty much every position. You just got to find them. And that's not an easy thing to do.
Right, that's the trick. And I'm not saying that they don't exist, but every GM probably reaches a point when he thinks that pool of players is exhausted, right? That there are no more great players at X position. Now, he may be wrong, but he's not going to draft a guy from that spot hoping he was wrong. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, to me, if I've said this, and I think I'm probably in the minority, if I feel Tunsil, and I'm not qualified to grade him compared to these other guys, but if Dave Caldwell were to feel that Laremy Tunsil were a perennial Pro Bowl type left tackle, one of those,
if he's a Hall of Famer, can't
or
miss,
if he's a Joe Thomas level guy, that's what I would definitely consider. Now, I'm a Bosa guy because I think they need pass rush, and you know, as much as I've watched Ohio State and everything I've heard about him, people seem to think he's a legit top five prospect.
Did you watch any of him last year, Bosa?
Very little.
Okay.
Very little. Okay. I know he's a big, kind of strong type of guy. But I usually, you know, with college football, which like I told you guys before, I don't watch a lot of college football.
Right.
But then when I get to about, you know, end of March, and that's when I'll start watching film of typically about the top, you know, 10, 15 prospects, and maybe a little bit more depending on the position and the quality of the position. That's when I really start looking at the film of those guys. And thank goodness I have that available to where I can watch it. But I'll jump into that in about March, probably.
Yep. We'll look forward
I might
to
even jump into a little bit sooner this year. You know, I'm going to be laid up for a little while. Got a little shoulder surgery, so I'll be bored out of my mind. And so I'll probably get after a little bit early this year.
Let's go to Steve in Pontevedra next up here on Jaguars Today. Good morning, Steve.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. Couple questions. First question: do you think we'll go O-line with the fifth pick? Second question: Sample or Cyprien? Do you think Sample is better than Cyprien? I know Cyprien was disastrous this year and looks the part, has the physical. He's a physical specimen, but there's no common sense on the field. Do you think we'll use a pick to shore that position up? What are your guys' thoughts on that?
Well, we kind of talked about the offensive lineman just a minute ago, but the safety is an interesting position. I think in a perfect world, what you'd like to do is to add that premium position that Caldwell and Gus Bradley talked about at length at the end of the year, which is the free safety. I think it was Dave that talked about it, and that the free safety spot can be just as difficult to find a guy there as sometimes as the quarterback position. I disagree with that, but it's hard, but it's not quite as hard as finding a quarterback. But in a perfect world, if you can find a true legitimate free safety, and then you come back next year and you allow competition to happen between James Sample and Jonathan Cyprien, that is a best-case scenario, period, and it would be awesome to have. Now, Cyprien, a lot of times people say, well, you know, boy, he was not very good. He had times he was fantastic. The game in London where he had to cause fumble there.
It seemed like he had a good period for a 2 or 3 week period.
He'll drive you nuts. So I have 2-3 games that are fantastic, and all of a sudden he's got 2 games. It's like, what the hell was that? You know, and the caller is right in making one statement about Cyprien, and that the awareness. And I think I said that last year about Jonathan Cyprien. In fact, I know I did, and said that his awareness on game situations and route combinations and everything else, it needs to improve. And I made the comment that whether it be film study or preparation or whatever, he needs to be able to spend more time with that. So, because the great players like an Ed Reed. A lot of people say that Ed Reed would take guesses. Ed Reed didn't take guesses. Ed Reed took educated guesses because Ed knew the system.
He played the odds.
Yeah. Ronnie Lott was no different. I remember playing with Ronnie Lott when we were in New York, and Ronnie would literally keep a notepad on coordinators. And so it was more about, with Ronnie, learning what the calling style was based on field position, down and distance, as it was lining up and seeing a formation and saying, well, they could run these 3 plays out of it. Ronnie went further than that. Down and distance, formation, and then past tendencies of the offensive coordinator. He would keep a notebook, much like Howie Long used to keep. Howie Long used to keep snap counts, game plans, line calls of every coach in the National Football League, because it's like it's a gypsy profession. You know, a guy would change from one team to the next, and he'd bring that same system and calling system with him to another location, and Howie would flip back through his notepad and say, okay, you know, 121, the snap counts on 2. It was always second number in that sequence of numbers when a quarterback got the line of scrimmage. Or red, white, and blue. Red, white, blue. 1, 2, 3. I mean, that's, you know, Howie Long had probably one of the greatest get-offs in the history of the game. And people are like, gosh, he was just so quick twitch. No. Howie knew the snap count a lot of times when he was at the line of scrimmage because he was such a student of the game.
Right.
the great players are able to take that step. And Jonathan Cyprian needs to take some steps in that direction.
All right, we got to take a timeout. That's the step we're going to take right now. We have open phone lines for you at 641-1010. But when we return in a moment, this date in football history and the Honda drive around the NFL with Jeff Augerman and Fat Tony. I'm Mike Dempsey. It's Jaguars today on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Now, Jaguars today on 1010XL 92.5 FM. And now, this date in football history.
All right, we got it chock full of goodies on this date in football history. Happy 110th anniversary to the forward pass.
Hey,
football rules committees legalized the forward pass in this date in 1906. 1946, just 40 short years later, the NFL champion Cleveland Rams were given permission to move to Los Angeles. You know, it's like this week is playing out over and over again for those guys. On 1958, the NCAA added a two-point conversion to football scoring opportunities. These are some pretty big milestones right here. 1969, the most impactful Super Bowl result perhaps of all time, Super Bowl III. The Jets beat the Colts on this date in football history with Joe Namath being the MVP.
It was in Miami, right?
It was in Miami. Yeah. People say it forced the merger. I read up on this and people feel that no matter the outcome of that game, the merger was inevitable between the National Football League and the AFL at that point in time. Also, this date in 1975, Super Bowl IX, the Steelers beat the Minnesota Vikings 16-6 in New Orleans. Franco Harris, the MVP of that one. And 1995, the murder trial against OJ began in Los Angeles. It's a lot going on January 12th, historically. Famous birthdays for this date. My father, Tom Dempsey, was born on this date.
Happy birthday.
Dad was born with a club foot, but he could kick the ball a long way. Wasn't really my father, but I don't get asked about Tom. I get asked about Jack Dempsey. Jack Dempsey really left an impression because people who are born 80 years after Jack Dempsey, Dempsey, like Jack Dempsey? I guess, yeah, sure, right. It's the same last name who for the longest time held solely the record of a 63-yard field goal. Now it's, what, 64? Janikowski? I want to say Janikowski kicked a 64-yarder.
I think so.
I'll check on that.
I know he attempted a 75-yard one.
I'll check that in a second. And then Chad Greenway and Drew Pearson, also born on this date. Five Pro Bowls between him. Pearson, the former All-Pro receiver for the Cowboys. Chad Greenway, a current linebacker for the Minnesota Vikings. That is this date in football history.
Now the Honda drive around the NFL. Brought to you by your First Coast Honda dealers.
Since the caller mentioned the playoff defenses this year, just an interesting stat to throw out there. 11 of the top 12 scoring defenses in the league made the playoffs this year. 8 of the top 12 scoring offenses made the playoffs this year. The only top 12 defense that didn't make the playoffs was the New York Jets, who coincidentally were also a top 12 scoring offense that didn't make the playoffs. Cincinnati Bengals linebacker Vontaze Burfict has been suspended for the first three games of the 2016 season by the NFL following his actions in the Bengals' wildcard loss to Pittsburgh on Saturday night. The NFL said that the three-game suspension is due to repeated violations of player safety rules. Burfict is going to appeal the suspension, according to Adam Kaplan of ESPN. The Steelers expect Ben Roethlisberger to probably be able to play this weekend against Denver, but wide receiver Antonio Brown, who was faking, according to Adam Pac-Man Jones, is in the league's concussion protocol and is being described as doubtful by the Steelers here early in the week. Carolina expects both running back Jonathan Stewart and wide receiver Ted Ginn Jr. to return to practice with the team tomorrow as they prepare for their divisional round matchup with Seattle. Both Stewart and Ginn missed the Panthers' Week 17 regular season finale.
This is all just part of Antonio Brown's long con to fool Pac-Man Jones
right. And
just thinking he's not really hurt if he doesn't show up and play in the playoffs this week. By the way, Matt Prater has a 64-yarder. Janikowski had a 63. He was one of several to equal the mark. Prater set it in 2013. Three of the five kicks that are 63 or 64 yards happened in Denver, by the way. Prater's came at home versus the Titans. Jason Elam kicked one against the Jaguars that tied the record back in 98 at 63 yards there. And then Sebastian Janikowski in a game at Denver for the Raiders did that as well in 2011. David Akers kicked a 63-yarder for San Fran at Green Bay. And, of course, Dempsey did it at home in New Orleans versus the Detroit Lions. So
Jason Myers has got an opportunity. You know, if given the opportunity, he's got the leg to kick one from 65.
That's the question, though, right? The opportunity because coaches fear the miss and then the field position that you give up so often, you only get it at the end of the first half.
Second half. End of either half, you know. But with the, as aggressive as the Jaguars have been at the end of the first half, I think he's going to have some opportunities there. You know, so, I mean, he's got incredibly, I mean, I've seen him kick 65-yarders in practice. I mean, he can make them.
Right. I think there are a lot of kickers like that. Have you seen him kick it with a rush, or have you just seen him line up
practice,
and kick it?
Practice, you know, where you got not a whole lot of rush.
Right. Because so, you wonder, you never know, are they getting the angle, are they getting it up high enough, are they trying to drill it?
That's the thing that I think is surprising about Jason, is that when he kicks, you know, the long ones, you know, and going back to my first education on kicking, you know, I played with a guy by the name of Pat Leahy in New York, and he was a long time kicker.
Played until over 40 years old, I want to say.
Yeah, great guy, and in fact was my neighbor for a couple years, and thanks to him and his wife for cooking me meals many times as a 21-year-old man. And he always talked about kicking as, in terms of golf, you know, the two iron, obviously for the longer kicks, and, you know, the extra point back then was a sand wedge, and where you're making contact on the ball, you know, with the trajectory and everything else. And Jason Myers, I don't think ever hits anything less than a 4 or 5 iron. I mean, that's kind of impressive that he gets the great elevation even on a 65 yarder that most kickers can't get, because he's got an incredibly strong leg. He just needs to clean up the extra points.
Clean up the extra points, and you know, Matt Walsh not able to do that this weekend. Matt Blair.
Blair Walsh.
God, it's in my head.
Matt Walsh is a basketball player.
Right. Who is Blair?
Blair Walsh is the kicker for Minnesota right now.
Matt Blair?
You said Matt Walsh.
What did they call him yesterday?
They called him Matt Blair.
They called him Matt Blair. And that's in my head now, obviously.
Yeah, it was like a linebacker
for Minnesota.
Matt Blair
used to play linebacker for the Vikings, yeah. Right? It's Blair Walsh. Who's Matt Walsh again?
Matt Walsh he's an NBA player, right?
Former Gator.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I knew it was familiar. All right. Blair Walsh.
Hey, that kick in the laces, although they were able to get away with it twice. You're talking, what, sub-zero temperatures and having the laces face you?
Is that more psychological, though? He sees the laces it's not?
No. To me, the laces, I mean, if you just think about it, if you ever tried to hit a golf ball that had one spot that wasn't round, I mean, that's, you're going to have the ball fly sometimes in an awkward direction, especially when it's sub-zero temperatures and the balls are that hard. All of a sudden now the laces become even less spongy, less forgiving of a kick right on the laces.
You think that's what caused it?
I think it absolutely contributed to it. Now, if he had not gotten the laces, would he have made it? I don't know. But I guarantee it wouldn't have been as bad as what it was.
Right. He said he rushed it and it didn't feel good the second it came off his foot. Maybe it's due to the laces. I saw one former special teams coordinator say, kick that short. It's going to impact the accuracy, but it shouldn't impact it to the degree you missed a 27-yarder.
Yeah, you shouldn't, but you know.
I hear you.
You mishit something. If all of a sudden you have a little mishit, you get a little bit more forgiveness if you don't have the laces versus having the laces.
Yeah. Make the 27-yard field goal.
Yeah.
What about what you make of what went down in the Cincinnati-Pittsburgh game?
You know, and I saw that Peter King had a letter to the NFL players. Did you read that?
I did not.
He wrote a kind of an open letter to the NFL players saying, you know, basically to summarize it, you need to take better care of yourselves. You need to take better care of the game. Set a better example to the youth of America for the future of football, et cetera. Look, I'm of the opinion – That's what makes the NFL great sometimes. I mean, if you go back and you think of some of the great rivalries and some of the things that went on, it's what makes it what it is. You know, and without that, to me, it becomes kind of, I don't know, bland. And to me, I was looking forward to that, to the chippiness, to the pregame stuff. I mean, it's almost
like.
Did
it ever go too far for you?
In that game? No. No, it didn't. I mean, I think the only thing I think that should have been different was when Joey Porter was on the field, the penalty that ended up being called on Pac-Man Jones. How do you not call Joey Porter for being out on the field and him receiving a penalty in that situation?
Right.
When it's been known that Joey Porter is the fire starter, is one of the contributing factors to some of the issues that they've had with Cincinnati in the past, and the officials should have been aware of that. And they weren't, because it would have been a flag immediately as soon as you see an assistant coach
right.
out on the
field. Right, it could have been a flag on him before it ever got, and it should have been then 15 yards just against Pittsburgh, which would have moved them back from the 15 they picked up from the perfect play.
If the penalty was called when he was on the field immediately, which it should have been.
Never would have gotten to.
Wouldn't have gotten heated right. as it did, and the penalty wouldn't have happened on Pac-Man Jones. And I'm not trying to make an excuse for Pac-Man Jones. But at the same token, if you're going to do it right, you need to do it right.
Right.
You know, the sack that Burfict had on Ben Roethlisberger has been highly scrutinized. I saw absolutely nothing wrong with that. He's making a sack, and while he's making the sack, he is making an attempt to strip the ball out, which makes it look like he's giving him the business. To me, I thought that was a clean play.
Right. I thought it was more clean than not. I did see an angle yesterday that showed he was maybe giving him the business a little longer after the play went down with the knee into the shoulder.
Yeah, and see, I didn't really see that. I saw a guy who was attempting to pull the ball out.
All right, so that's fine, because I tend to agree with you. That hit, mm-hmm. I was comfortable with. What about the play when Burfict hit Antonio Brown?
Cheap shot.
Right.
Good
call. I mean, you can't make
defenseless
that play.
Defenseless receiver doesn't have the ball in his hands, can't protect himself. The
play the
rules
is long
are
over with.
That's it's an easy call. The Ryan Shazier hit, to me, should have been a penalty, because I didn't think that Giovanni Bernard was at the point to where he could protect himself.
I didn't either, but then they made it seem like it's simple. All you have to do as a running back is turn around, you know, and square your shoulders
It was the one, even the crown, which is typically the area what they call above the face mask. That was the top
right.
of the helmet.
Spear.
Yeah, it was a spear.
But I was looking at some rules interpretations on this as well, and they were saying, well, if it happens kind of bang bang, they're not going to flag you, and they don't have to flag you for hitting with the crown or the top, whatever you want to call it, of the helmet. It's more when you line a guy up in your sights. And you've got time to run in there. That they felt that was more Bernard turned, set, boom, bang, bang, head to head.
Set, but couldn't react.
I mean, understand.
To me, still in a defensive position.
I understand. I agreed with you as well, but there are interpretations that feel like this, you know, it's not crazy to interpret it the way that the referees interpret it.
No, it's not. But, I mean, to me, that's what makes rivalries great, was you have a little bit of controversy like that. I mean, if it's just a great competitive game, I mean, that little bit of extra sometimes gives it that flair of a heavyweight weigh-in title match.
Well, that, we sit back here without a dog in the hunt, and it's easy to say that. If you're calling a Jags game and somebody gets a stupid unsportsmanlike penalty, I doubt you're saying that's just adding to the rivalry with the Colts in Week 17 for a chance to win the division title.
Well, no, I mean, if it's one of the Jaguars players, I mean, and he commits an act like that, I mean, you call it the way you see it.
Right.
He should have been penalized for that. I mean, if you go back, you remember when Donovan Darius clotheslined the guy?
Sure, Robert Ferguson.
St. Louis?
Green Bay.
Green Bay game. When he did that, I said he should have been penalized for that. I mean, it was a vicious hit. It was an illegal hit right to the head and neck area, which the rules were a little bit different then. But
I understand the chippiness. I'm just talking about, you know, you're in a big situation, man. Be smart. Don't kill your team.
No
don't
doubt.
don't be macho to the point where it's going to cost you a chance to advance in the postseason.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate, because Burfict is, I mean, he's an excellent player.
He's a very good player,
but
he's got a reputation as being among the dirtiest players in the National Football
League. No doubt, and there's a couple other plays in the game to where he has an offensive lineman coming at him, and Burfict has a little bit of a history with this, and that the play is kind of ending and a blocker is approaching him, and he launches himself at times right into the head and neck area of that particular blocker. And that's kind of his M.O. What he did a couple years ago or last year, whenever it was, where he was twisting the ankle of the Carolina Panthers.
Cam Newton. Yeah.
To me, that should have resulted in a suspension there. And the three games that he got, it's not about one play. It's about the history that he has.
All right. And he got fined. You see this? He got fined in Week 17 for his hit on
Max Williams.
Right. And that wasn't publicly announced before the broadcast, so that factored into it as well. And, you know, so some of the questions have been, you know, did Marvin Lewis know about that? Did he know he's on the brink of, you know, potentially getting himself suspended? What do you think the NFL would have done if, let's say, Boswell misses the last field goal and Cincinnati advances? You think they're still suspending Burfict for three games starting this week?
No.
I don't either.
Nope.
I don't think they don't want to touch the playoffs.
Those wheels move pretty quick with him being out of the
playoffs. Right, we're going to have to review this and appeal this. Right, he's out of the playoffs, and within 24 hours, we know this guy's suspended for three games.
That would be either a significant fine or it's going to be reviewed.
Yeah.
That's what the situation would have been with that.
Right.
Do you think, and because this has been part of the conversation, too, coming out of that game, because of how many of those style of hits we saw, you saw the Wheaton play that got flagged, the Bernard play that didn't, and then the Antonio Brown play at the end of the game there, but both plays against Cincinnati being called and the one against Pittsburgh that didn't happen to be flagged in that game, which was part of the rage, I think, that Cincinnati was feeling towards the end of that contest. Some people are saying they should govern it more like they do in college, where what they call a targeting foul, that forcible contact to the head or neck, not only results in a penalty, but results in an ejection for the offending player in a game. Should the NFL be considering something like that?
No, because I've seen the flip side of that. I mean, I agree with you that certain ones should be, but the problem with that is that you're having to make a decision in a quick situation without really truly understanding it or reviewing it, and
sure,
then putting that in the hands of an official, and it becomes a judgment call with one person. You know, you've seen it happen at the college level to where a guy makes a hit, and he's not necessarily targeting the area of the head and neck, but because of something the offensive player does, that's what ends up being the result. To me, the intent always has to be considered. And I think in the college game, intent is not even a factor, and I think that's a problem.
All right, he is Jeff Logman along with Fat Tony. I'm Mike Dempsey here on Jaguars Today. If you'd like to get in, talk a little Jag football, talk NFL playoff football, you want to talk about the draft, free agency upcoming, or the question of the day, which is this: what do you think are the top three plays of the year for the Jacksonville Jaguars? Phone lines open to you at 641-1010. Also, the Boston's Restaurant and Sports Bar text line at the same number. And you can, of course, tweet us at MD_1010XL, at 1010XL Fat Tony, and at Logs56, LOGS56. Jaguars Today continues in a moment on 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
Now more with Jeff Lagerman, brought to you by Roland Reich Plumbing on Jaguars Today, 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
All right, question of the day today for you Jaguar listeners out there. Who are the top three plays for the Jags in 2015? You can cast your votes on Twitter, on Facebook, however you like. You can call into the program at 641-1010. J.P. Shadrick is compiling a number of members of the media's thoughts on that for, I'm sure, a feature on Jaguars.com that will highlight the top plays. I'm guessing maybe, Jeff, an off-season countdown of some kind.
Yeah, it's exactly what we'll do. We did something similar to this last year where you have the actual play and the call during the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then we actually take each play and break it down on film. You know, so it's kind of a three-part kind of a thing with each play, and you roll one out, I think one every week or however that works, and looking forward to it. It's fun to break them down on film because there's always a little bit more to it than meets the eye.
We'll get to our votes. So we'll go through like our top five here coming up here in a few minutes and just kind of kick some of those around for memory's sake. But let's look ahead while we got you here to the upcoming weekend in the National Football League playoffs. So the first time ever in the wild card round, four road teams won.
Yeah, but no surprise there. I mean, I wasn't
surprised. No surprise. I don't think any game, even if Houston had won the home game, I wouldn't have been shocked. I thought all those games were toss-ups. It didn't play out that way with Houston, Kansas City. I did think Washington would win the game just based on recent form.
Yeah, me and Vaselli went back and forth on that one. He was picking the Redskins. He's got a little bit of a slant towards the Redskins because Joe Barry, the defensive coordinator, is a good friend of his.
Okay.
But I just couldn't, and I made the comment to Tony. I said, look, I just can't imagine Aaron Rodgers getting beat by Kirk Cousins in the playoff, and Kirk Cousins will have a Kirk Cousins moment. And he really didn't.
No.
He really didn't. And Aaron Rodgers, in the first part of that game, was not like an Aaron Rodgers that we've watched many years before.
Right.
He was missing guys.
Missing guys,
yeah.
Exactly. It wasn't just that the guys weren't getting open or dropping passes. He was just missing guys. Yep.
It was on him, and I think that all season long people have kind of taken the easy explanation of Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers' fortunes of name it while Jordy Nelson's not there.
Yeah.
That's part of it, but the offensive line struggles.
Offensive
are a big
line
part of it
and
as
Aaron
well.
Rodgers has been struggling.
And
too.
He has. He had, by his standards, but you look back and he had like 30 touchdowns, 7 picks this year. 31-7, something like that.
Yeah, it was 31-7.
And you're like, man,
still great.
Wouldn't you love to struggle like that? Wouldn't you love your bad season to be
that's,
that?
That's amazing because that's how great of a player he is.
Right. And you note that he threw for only 3,800 yards this year, which that to me is the more shocking thing in today's NFL and how prolific as he's been, that number was below 4,000 yards.
Yeah, and really that game turned for me. It felt like Washington was in complete control until they started trying to substitute when Green Bay was running no huddle. And two times on that one drive, time it got caught for just the first down with the cheap 5 yards, and then the second time it resulted in a touchdown because, again, they tried to sub when Green Bay was just running to the line of scrimmage. And I was watching going, what are you doing? You know you can't sub. I mean, you know you're not going to have time, especially against a guy like Rodgers who's getting him to the line that quick. And from there, it felt like whatever grasp Washington had on the momentum of that game, it was gone. Like, after Green Bay really scored that first touchdown, everything started rolling for them. They felt good about what they were doing on offense, and they didn't for the first quarter and a half.
And the ground game of Green Bay, I mean, really kind of took control of the tempo, you know. And it's, you know, give Green Bay's head coach, Mike McCarthy, some credit now, because it would be easy to just start to put it all on Aaron Rodgers' shoulder in that situation, but he didn't. You know, he kept and stuck with the ground game, and it was effective. And
a lot of it
smart.
Was James Starks, too.
James Starks had a wonderful game.
James Starks seems to show up in the postseason. You remember when they won the one Super Bowl in the Aaron Rodgers era?
Yeah.
James Starks had a phenomenal postseason run.
And it was also good because, you know, the left tackle that they had playing in that game obviously was not the usual starter.
Right.
And I think he was a backup interior offensive lineman that was playing tackle. And he did an admirable job. He actually did a pretty good job. And the Redskins' pass rush, I thought it would be better on the inside than what it was. And Terrence Knighton looked absolutely huge.
Enormous,
still.
Right. But I saw him he made a play. Like, he stuffed, maybe it was Lacy for a tackle for a loss. And I thought, I bet if I go to Twitter right now, there are 100 people tweeting about how do the Jaguars let Terrence Knighton get away. Yeah. And it's just that kind of drives me
28th.
Crazy.
28th against the run Washington this year.
He looked like a big, oversized peanut M&M. He was enormous.
I'd heard that Dan Snyder had actually hired, for Terrence Knighton, a nutritionist and a chef to help him lose weight. Well, it didn't work.
No. He ate the nutritionist.
He's still sneaking those Snickers when he wants.
Got the chef in the freezer.
What a shame, because you know what? When Terrence was here, and Terrence was about 315, well, wait a minute. When he was close to 315, 320, because he was never 315, 320, Terrence Knighton's an athlete now. He has a good pass rush way about him. But he could never fight it. You know, he could never push back from the table. And it killed him every year. He would show up 365, 375, and play down to 345. If Terrence ever had any self-control, and I like Terrence. Terrence is a great guy. He's a smart guy. But if he ever was able to find a way to be committed and got down to 315, 320, he would be an every down player. He'd be making $5, $6 million a year because he has that ability.
Well, let's look at the matchups this week. And you tell me which of the road teams you think are most likely to win, if not win, the best odds to win. Okay, I think it's interesting because Pittsburgh plays Denver, and it was just a few weeks ago when Ben Roethlisberger and Antonio Brown carved them up. Right now, you got Roethlisberger probably playing at less than 100%, and early indications are Antonio Brown may be a long shot to play in this game at all. With everything that's going on, can you see Pittsburgh going into Denver and winning the game this weekend?
Yes,
you can.
Yeah,
because Peyton Manning.
I can, but I don't think it's a great chance.
I don't either.
I'm not a big fan of, well, Peyton Manning has arrived and now he's.
Oh, I don't buy that either.
Yeah, I'm not on that because, you know, Peyton, you know, we haven't seen much of him besides what he played last week or a couple weeks ago. And it wasn't like it was the Peyton Manning of old that we saw, you know, but Denver's defense is just so good. Pittsburgh's offensive line, the tackles, which has got to play really well against Denver. They've been doing a pretty good job in Pittsburgh. That left tackle, what's his name, Villanueva?
Mm-hmm.
He's doing a tremendous job for Pittsburgh. Tremendous job. And a great story there.
All right, Kansas City going to New England. I think the Chiefs have an excellent chance to win this football game.
Yeah, and who's going to be playing for New England on offense? That's the big question.
Edelman says he'll be back, says he wants to go full throttle. So he says.
I read that, and, you know, we also thought that Marshawn Lynch was going to play in Minnesota, and then also
that was a weird situation, though. Something's up with that situation.
Very strange.
Right.
You know, I don't know. Kansas City's playing really good football. You can't discount the fact that they've won 11 in a row now.
I think they can get Brady to move out of his comfort zone. You know,
could, but it's that's going to be an interesting matchup. I just don't think it's very likely. Is there a chance? I think it's
who do you give a better chance to, Pittsburgh or Kansas City?
Pittsburgh.
I would say Kansas City.
Me too.
Okay.
I think they got
you two. Which one?
Kansas City. I think that they're physical enough at the corner position with Peters and Smith that if they need to bump and run, they can up there and try to neutralize a little bit of that quick offense from New England. I think they match up better with New England than a lot of teams would, especially in this situation where New England really hasn't been the same team offensively for the last 5 weeks.
Yeah, to me, there's only one team that matches up with New England well, and that's the Jets, because they got the horses up front. They have the secondary that has quick coverage skills. The Kansas City backfield is a little longer. Not quite as quick. So I think that's not a great matchup. That's why I say I want to see who plays. You know, is Edelman and Amendola all going to play? If so, it's going to be one of those quick passing games and Tom Brady can knife you up. And New England's playing pretty good ball on defense now. Pretty good ball.
NFC, Seattle, a lot of people are anticipating this matchup. Seattle's a 6 seed going to Carolina. Carolina won on a last minute drive touchdown to Greg Olsen up in the Pacific Northwest about midway through the season. I don't know if you draw anything from that. Seattle had been red hot, and then Minnesota's defense cooled them off a little bit last week. Can Carolina do the same, do you think, this week?
I think that this is going to be the game of the week in my mind. I think this is a pick 'em game. Seattle's got the experience. Carolina has been playing exceptionally well this year. And this is a game that also I can't wait to see if Marshawn Lynch plays, because if he plays, he is a difference maker. He has the ability to take over a game. But what is going on up there with that situation is anybody's guess, you know, because I don't know if anybody is really close enough to Marshawn Lynch to actually be able to know.
Jeff, I was talking to their sideline reporter like 2 days before the game. And Liz Matthews is her name. She works. She's John Clayton's producer up there for his show. And she was convinced. She's like, he's going to play. He's going to get about 20 carries in this football game. That he's going to be the focal point of this offense this week, notwithstanding how well Russell Wilson's been playing. And I don't know, something fishy about this. I don't think it's as clean as we try to get him ready, and he just wasn't ready enough to play.
Yeah, who knows? But it's, you know, the Carolina Panthers. Obviously, their defense is tremendous. No Charles Tillman. I think that hurts a little
bit. Right, towards ACL.
But they've got, you know, Josh Norman might be the best corner in the league.
This year, yeah.
You know, we've got best linebacking core in the league, I think. The guy, they can rush the passer up front. I think this is going to be a fantastic football game. And what time is kickoff on that one?
That one is the 1 o'clock game on Sunday.
All right. I just wanted to make sure so that I'm right in front of the TV.
They're doing Denver-Pittsburgh as the late game because it's potentially Peyton Manning's final game, you know, and they're going to build towards that all weekend. And then finally you got Arizona, who just whacked Green Bay a few weeks ago. I mean, absolutely demolished the Packers, but then absolutely got demolished themselves against Seattle in Week 17. I think it's going to be a lot closer than the first time around. I don't think Arizona's going to lose this football game.
No, they don't. I just don't. I don't see it. I mean,
this is more like a 34-24 to me than just a manhandling.
34-20, something like that. You know, but it stays close, and then all of a sudden a late score kind of puts it away. The job that Bruce Arians has done in Arizona is just tremendous. And it's not just him. It's the general manager. I mean, they've been able to find – and almost similar to what Bill Belichick was able to do in New England for a number of years, to where they find guys, you know, like a Dwight Freeney, that aren't productive somewhere else, and they're able to get something out of them. And Bruce Arians just seems to have that ability. Carson Palmer's playing exceptionally well. They've got talented running back core. Obviously, Larry Fitzgerald, and the receiving core solid. I mean, as far as well-rounded teams go, Arizona can make it happen.
Oh, those wide receivers playing well enough, Rod Tidwell can't even get on the field right now. So show them the money, but don't show them any playing time out there in the desert. All right, we'll come back and take a look at the fan feedback spotlight. We'll give you our votes for the top five plays of the year, asking you for your top three plays as a Jaguar fan that the Jags produced in 2015. We'll look at some of your responses and kick around some of the top nominees coming up next on Jaguars Today here on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Now more with Jeff Lagerman, brought to you by Roland Reich Plumbing on Jaguars Today, 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Final few minutes here at Jaguars Today. Question of the day is this. What are your top three plays for the Jacksonville Jaguars in 2015? We got a couple of callers on the line who want to cast their votes, and we'll go around the table and give ours. Let's start with Leo in Fruit Cove. Hi, Leo.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I'll be brief. You guys have been talking about a lot of good things today, especially with Jeff, because I called you last week, Mike, and we're talking about, you know, the draft pick and how I really like Tunsil. And Jeff explained it perfectly earlier. You guys were saying that when you draft that offense, that premier guy, you say what? Okay, this star guy for 10 years, we're set. I'm going to ask you guys a question, and you don't have to answer me on the radio. I can take your thoughts off the air and whatnot. Do you think that we have that guy right now, our 10-year guy? We don't have to worry about left tackle. We're good there?
No. That's my answer.
Yeah. No, I agree with you.
So?
I don't think you have a hands where you firmly know that he's our guy. I think that you could say, I think we have our guy because he got better. But it's easy to remember the last game where he gave up five. And great players that are answers and cornerstones don't give up five in a game.
Right. That's fair. Leo, thank you. Let's go to Ryan in Arlington before we get to our votes here. Ryan, welcome to Jaguars Today. What can we do for you?
Hey, good morning, guys. I was going to call and give my top plays, but I guess I missed that segment. So I'll just
no, go ahead. That's what we're doing. Go ahead if you got it.
Oh, okay. My first top play, he's not a Jaguar, but he definitely made an amazing play for the Jags. Doomerville's little face mask there that shouldn't have ever happened to give us a game-winning field goal. Probably one of my top plays of the season. Number two would probably be Alan Hearn. Pass that should have been intercepted, but he ran that down for an 80-yard touchdown against the Colts. And then a quick question. Watching the Packers earlier this season, every time a defensive lineman would jump off sides, Aaron Rodgers would just basically bomb it down the, you know, down the sideline for a free play. I'm just wondering why the Jags don't really do that. Every time, you know, someone jumps off, it seems like Bortles just, you know, drops the ball on the ground and they don't attempt anything. Maybe I'm just harping on the little things, but just had a question about that.
I mean, it's a great question, you know, and the question that I would turn around and ask you that is, how many times did you ever see Blake Bortles run the hard count? Not much, you know, and I think that that's a kind of a progress of a quarterback working towards that. And I think eventually once the offense is stable and from year to year, you're not worried about X's and O's and you can kind of work on some of the intricacies of the game, then I think that's the next step for Blake Bortles.
Keep in mind, at this point in Aaron Rodgers' career, he was getting ready to sit his third year on the bench.
Right.
Right? And so it will be three more years before he had as much playing experience as Blake Bortles has at this point.
But that will definitely come. I mean, because, you know, quarterbacks that have experience, they use the snap count, the hard count, to find a way to make plays like that. And so when you go into a huddle and you know that you have a play that's called that has a deep option, you're going to say, okay, there's some deep option here. It's not necessarily my primary, but let me use the snap count here, hard count. And then if I do get somebody off sides, I know I'm going to take a shot deep because I might have a free play. But that's the, you know, it takes time to get a quarterback to that level, and hopefully next year we start to see some of that out of Blake.
All right, thank you for the call, Ryan. Let's go to Tyler Devitt first up. Tyler, we asked you to rank. J.P. Shadrick gave us a list of potential plays. We're not limited to those necessarily, but I think we all probably stuck to them for the purposes of this. Tyler, give us your top five plays of the season for the Jaguars.
It was tough. Number five, I went with the Doomerville-Myers game-winning combo play right there. Number four, I went with Allen Robinson breaking his single-season touchdown record. Three, Bortles in the passing of Brunell in the single-season yardage record. Number two, Andre Branch, the sack, strip, recovery, and touchdown. And number one, I had to do with the Alan Hearns game-winning catch in London.
All right, Tony, what do you have? 5-1.
Number five, I had the Allen Hurns 80-yard touchdown catch, which how he didn't see the safety or react to the safety on that play is still just incredible to me. Number four, the Rashad Green punt return against Tennessee. In a game where it felt like everything was dead in the water for this Jacksonville team at home on Thursday night against a division rival, playoffs still very much in the picture for this team, Rashad Green woke him up again and gave him an opportunity to win that game. Number three, the Andre Branch strip sack recovery 49-yard touchdown against Indianapolis in the route here at home. Number two, and it's really the two plays that when I think about the Jags 2015 season, I think I'll remember forever. And two is the end of that Baltimore game and just the Keystone Cops aspect of everything that had to happen right for the Jacksonville Jaguars on that play. For Doomerville to be the only other guy on the field that was still playing on the play among the front on either side and to have the face mask and then the field goal to win it, that's number two for me. And number one, the image of Hurns catching that ball in the end zone is the lasting image of the 2015 season for me against Buffalo.
All right, Loggy, what do you have? Top five.
I got the Keystone Cop plays at five.
Okay.
Okay, and what a great job by Jason Myers there on a 53-yard free play. It's always nice. Rashad Green at number four with the punt return touchdown, 73 yards. And
oh, you went with the one against Indy, yeah. 73-yard. Okay, mm-hmm. For the touchdown, gotcha.
And A-Rob's double move touchdown against Miami was number three. Andre Branch with the quadfecta is number two. And then Hearns' catch in London, a huge play for this football team and a great comeback.
All right, for me, my number five was, and I'm the only one who probably ranked this one this highly, it sounds like, but Telvin Smith's 26-yard interception return against Buffalo. I felt that was, to me, that was more emblematic of that game. I realized Hearns, who I have, I think, ranked seventh with the game-winning catch. Without that, they don't win the game, but that to me, that game felt like the jailbreak of defensive plays was really what I focus on when I think about that football game. So that was number five. I had Odrick's strip sack of Ryan Tannehill that helped preserve the victory, the first one of the season for the Jags against Miami. I had Green's 63-yard punt return against Tennessee, like you did, Tony, where he got tackled inside, because I thought that was the momentum changer. I felt like the one against Indy was more an icing on the cake or building on the momentum that they already had snowballing, although I do have that one in at number nine. I had Doomerville, the face mask, Myers game-winning kick at number two, and I mentioned earlier I went with Andre Branch's quadfecta for the number one play. That one was easy. When I thought best plays of the season, that one I don't even have to think. I'll probably remember that play for a long, long time in terms of Jaguar history.
You know? Yeah, the reason I had the Hurns catch in London, you know, the significance of that play for this football team, for the initiative that they had in London,
sure,
I think is monumental.
And not blowing a game that they had.
They had
under the control.
Yeah.
Right? So they're definitely, like, it found a place in my top 10, and I don't doubt that I probably will rank that one lower in the end than most people will.
Yeah, if I had to pick the toughest play, or the play that I remember, probably one of, I mean, I remember a lot of them, all these, but the one that really stands out from an individual standpoint was Hearns' 80-yard catch against Indy where the safety's getting ready to blow him up 1 week after he was out because of a concussion. And the no fear that Allen Hurns had in that situation to be able to make the catch and still keep his feet underneath of him and to turn and run was just a tremendous individual play.
I had that one at number six, actually.
Yeah, I think there were 21 or 22 plays they sent out on the email to be ranked for the top 10 and just put them in order. Was there a play that wasn't on that list that you remember from this year? I think, for me, the one that we kind of talked around earlier but didn't directly mention was the 58-yard field goal going into half against Miami, without which maybe they're not even positioned to win that football game.
Yeah, that's a big one.
That'd be a good one. But yeah. Just the decision to try to get in scoring position there was
keep in mind, because he had already missed an extra point in that game.
Yeah.
Right? And I had missed at least one field goal in that game as well. Because I mentioned earlier when Posluszny's interception set him up in good position, he missed, Myers missed a 40-something yard field goal at the end of that drive. And then, the Jags, after Carolina took a 10-3 lead, they scored, had a chance to tie it, missed the extra point. And so then, the field goal, you know, to trot him out there in those circumstances was a big decision.
Well, it would have been easy because he had the ball coming out, second half, I think, in that game, if I remember right. And so it would have been easy to say, take a knee, go in at halftime, be happy with where you're at,
right,
come back out with the ball.
Right. Yeah. They're not doing that though. They're going to be.
No, I mean, that's, I mean, that was a bold decision.
Yeah.
You know, a bold decision because, the year before, you know, it didn't work out, you know, in that situation. All of a sudden you'd have an interception. Blake might throw an interception or pick six and you're like, oh, geez, you know, but they just kind of said, look, or, you know, let's go for it. And they did.
All right, Loggy, when they fixing you up? Anytime soon?
Next week.
Next week?
Yeah, so I'm not going to miss any shows here.
Oh, look at this good. Guy. He's going to play good. Hurt.
Heck yeah.
So you're going to get Jaguars today, and then they'll cut on you after that, and you get to sit back and enjoy.
Take a weekend.
Take the edge off.
Won't miss the outdoor show either, a couple days after surgery.
He's
a
tough guy.
Just another one to add to the list.
What we would have expected from you. All right, Logs, good stuff, buddy. We'll see you next Tuesday. Jeff Logman on Twitter, at Logs56, L-O-G-S-5-6. For Fat Tony, for Tyler Devitt, for Joe Fortunato, I'm Mike Dempsey. Thanks for playing along today. Didn't get to read a lot of the fan feedback spotlight today, but a lot of people choosing from among the similar ones. A lot of love for Allen Robinson's 90-yard touchdown catch as well, which is certainly one that I considered heavily as well. That'll do it for us today. XL Primetime coming up next on 1010 XL and 92.5 FM.
Now, Duval, give me two claps and a Ric Flair.
Woo! That's great job!